smile. Though your heart is aching, smile, even though it's breaking, when there are clouds.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
If you smile.
Welcome back, Indianapolis. This is another exciting edition of Saturday Night on the Circle.
Maybe tomorrow.
I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. You can catch my podcast uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. Producer Carl, beep, 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 pushing those buttons and doing the things to make the show function. Thank you, Producer Carl, doing an excellent job as always. An exciting show to round up. Lots of important topics to discuss, beginning, of course, with the Greenwood Park Mall shooting, which took place last Sunday, a little after 6 p.m., when reports started rolling in about a shooting there at the Greenwood Park Mall. My initial thought was, I mean, at least this time it isn't a school, before they turn to the victims in the mall. But thanks for tuning in, by the way, to this week's edition of the show. Again, catch the podcast upload to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. We learned in the wake of this tragedy that the heroic, quick thinking, and brave action of one 22-year-old hero saved many more lives from being taken that day. And we certainly don't celebrate the tragedy and devastating loss of life that was inflicted on three needless victims in the mall that day. But we do celebrate the hero whose quick thinking saved many more fatalities from potentially occurring. We heard a lot of the 911 audio that was released from the Greenwood Park Mall shooting by Police Chief Jim Eisen on Wednesday morning. And you can hear the desperation of neighbors in the Indianapolis area scrambling to get away from the shooter. And it was really chilling, harrowing stuff.
911, where's your emergency?
Hi, I'm at Greenwood Park Mall, and there was an open shot fired.
Did you see what the person looked like?
No, I was in a store, and everybody just started running.
Okay, is there still shots being fired?
I don't think so. I'm all the way in the back of Old Navy.
Okay,
a bunch of people hiding.
Stay in a safe place.
Just one of dozens of calls. Almost immediately, the lines were overwhelmed by people who were panicked and attempting to alert law enforcement officers. You can hear in a lot of the interactions, the trauma that the shooting immediately caused for people through the audio. But fortunately, the shooter was dealt with in less than 15 seconds, which is truly remarkable, according, again, to Greenwood Police Chief Jim Eisen on a press release on Tuesday. He'd originally stated that it took about 2 minutes to neutralize the shooter. That was an error, and he corrected it on Tuesday, saying that the shooting began at 5:56 p.m. And then ended 15 seconds later at 5:57:03. So this is a perfect demonstration of how effective and efficient response from armed citizens acting in self-defense can be. This 22-year-old outgunned more than 300 dithering law enforcement officers in Uvalde, and his quick thinking ensured that more lives wouldn't be lost. But that said, this kind of intervention is frustratingly infrequent, and that was reported on by WTHR, our news gathering partners.
Lauren, tonight you found out just how rare this kind of ending is for these active shooter situations.
That's right, Scott. Tonight I dug through data from researchers who study active shooter events and train people on them. Only about 5% end the way this did. They reviewed about 464 shootings over 20 years. In 73 cases, a bystander stopped the shooter before police arrived. 49 of those happened when someone physically stopped them, and 24 happened when a witness shot them. Now, this is only for active shooting situations, but it shows how unique this was. And thankfully, Eli was in the right place at the right time, saving countless lives.
Yes, he did.
So in more than 20 years, this study revealed that in more than 400 active shooter incidents, less than 5% were stopped by armed civilians, which is, again, frustratingly small considering the alarming frequency of these attacks. But Eli Dickin was the hero of this situation, acting coolly, calmly, and quickly to neutralize the threat. And also, this was enabled because of recent legislation that was passed in the state of Indiana, the constitutional carry bill. Of course, our own Guy Relford from the Gun Guy Show was instrumental in helping argue and pass that legislation, along with lawmakers, of course. Because of that, Eli Dicken was enabled and empowered to lawfully carry this firearm without need of a permit. And indeed, according to law enforcement officers, he did not have a permit to carry, but was legally entitled to, thanks to the constitutional carry bill that went into effect as of July 1st. There are more examples, of course, to discuss of civilians exercising their right to self-defense effectively and with positive results. And that should always be taken into consideration. Another citizen and exercising the right to self-defense saved lives last week in Missouri when a Good Samaritan saved the day at a Quick Trip gas station in St. Charles. When he arrived to refuel before leaving, he noted a black SUV and decided to stick around at the gas station just to see what went down. Turns out his suspicions were justified when the man in the SUV proceeded to assault the gas station attendant, pulling a knife and holding it to her throat. He went in into the store. He was armed, again, exercising his right to concealed carry. And the suspect charged at him, and he was forced to shoot him four times when subsequently the civilian and the store clerk called police. Emergency medical treatments transported the suspect, later identified as Lance Bush, who was a 26-year-old homeless man from St. Louis, to the hospital where he subsequently died. And what's really galling about this incident and highlights the necessity for self-defense rather than relying on law enforcement response, because he'd already robbed at least one other gas station earlier in the day, also holding a knife to the throat of that attendant. So this crime was not an isolated incident, and without the intervention of that civilian, who knows how this situation may have ended. Also in Indiana, earlier just today, there was successful civilian intervention when the life of a law enforcement officer was threatened on the border between Illinois and Indiana on the state line when state police were investigating a wreck on I-80 and 94 about 2 a.m. when a 2016 Dodge Charger slammed into a fire truck and a Subaru, sending the Subaru spinning out of control and pinning the officer responding to the scene, Trooper William Carlson, to a barrier wall. Witnesses observed this go down, and Brian K. Smith, 23, of North Carolina, the driver of that Charger, attempted to get away, leaving his passenger seriously injured in the vehicle. So what a despicable scumbag, by the way. Attempts to flee the scene. Other civilians see this go down, drive to intercept him, stop him, and hold him at gunpoint until law enforcement officers can arrive, thusly helping to save the life of that officer who was pinned to the wall and able to intervene in that situation. Smith being held in a Lake County jail with charges pending, and highlighting how, again, effective civilian response can be when the right to self-defense is protected. And some listeners have heard me struggle with where that line should be drawn, especially with the rise of mass shootings, particularly school shootings. One happens about every 2 years, resulting in fatalities of 10 or more students, which is an inordinate tragedy, but that shouldn't necessarily excuse an incursion into individual rights to self-defense, especially when there are imminent threats that could be encountered on a daily basis, and you need to be empowered with the right to self-defense in order to protect yourself, in order to protect the lives of others. And you cannot rely on the effectiveness of law enforcement when one 22-year-old intervening in a mass shooting effectively stops the threat in seconds, when it took more than 300 officers in a school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, more than an hour to neutralize the shooter while children were screaming for their lives. So yes, I think individuals do need the right to self-defense, and that discussion is, of course, going to continue to take center stage, recently being reignited when Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg attempted to charge a bodega owner for stabbing a customer during a altercation that reinvigorated that debate about self-defense and victimization. On July 1st, someone entered his store shouting profanities at the owner, and then after payment was declined for a bag of chips, he came behind the counter, shoving him, and this resulted ultimately in the customer being stabbed. And charges were originally filed against the worker at the bodega, which never should have happened. Again, exercising his right to self-defense when he was being physically threatened. And now, fortunately, those charges have been dropped. But again, it brings into center focus the idea of why our right to self-defense should be protected, certainly to stave off ridiculous responses from that by activist liberal prosecutors who have less interest in prosecuting real criminals than they do civilians acting well within their rights to self-defense in a dangerous situation. Important topics to discuss. If you missed a moment of the conversation, catch my podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on the Circle.fireside.fm. We have a lot more conversation to come on the show. Stay tuned, because in the next segment, I'm going to invite my friend Abdul Shabazz onto the program. Together, we're going to discuss the upcoming contentious special legislative session on Monday. It promises to be a doozy, with one of the most consequential pieces of legislation being floated before the members of the General Assembly. Likely any of them will see during their tenure. So we're going to cover all that and get to it in the next segment. Stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
So every time you stumble, never grumble.
Next time you bumble, even less. For up from the ashes, grow the roses of success.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Grow the roses of...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is 93 WIBC, and I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, sitting in the studio with my friend Abdul Shabazz, and together we're going to discuss what promises to be one of the most contentious special legislative sessions for the General Assembly in years, dealing with one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that many of these legislators will see during their tenure. And of course, Indiana promises to take center stage in the national debate surrounding abortion rights now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned and that issue has returned to the state. So, Abdul, of course, you were there at the press conference on Wednesday when...
Thank you for reminding me. I appreciate it. I love you too, big guy.
President pro tem of the Senate here in Indiana, Senator Rod Bray, outlined the proposed legislation, which would essentially outlaw abortion with exceptions for in the cases of life of the mother, rape, incest, or health of the child. So that being said, the Indiana Republicans are in a very precarious position because the legislation as it currently sits doesn't please the most disparate groups. On the one hand, it displeases moderates who find it restrictive to the access to abortion services. And on the other hand, you have the Republican base, which wants to see absolutely all forms of abortion outlawed.
So, which tells me the bill's probably in the right place because everybody's mad and nobody likes it.
But at the same time, there's room for improvement. And I feel like that's going to be the case, especially since they debuted this through the Senate in order to get the most pro-life bent. But it's probably going to go through some changes when it hits the House. What say you? Because you have usually the most informed and reasoned perspective on legislative affairs, which is why I wanted to talk to Abdul on this subject.
No problem, my friend. Well, you're right. The bill would outlaw abortion with the exception of rape, incest, life of the mother, or substantial impact on the mother. There are no criminal penalties for the woman nor the doctor, except the doctor or the healthcare professional who performed the abortion could lose their license to practice medicine here in Indiana. There are no outlaw on any sort of birth control. Matter of fact, they're expanding birth control and also putting dollars behind adoption and for foster care, because one of the big criticisms of the pro-life movement is not really pro-life, it's just pro-birth. And once the kids get here, then you don't care. Republicans are very cognizant of that, and so they've done some things to sort of mitigate those circumstances.
When you say it includes expanding access to birth control, does that include abortifacients like Plan B?
Yes.
Okay.
It does not. But it does not ban Plan B or any sort of medications. Now, what's interesting is it's a ban on abortion, including the first trimester, which I asked Senator Bray. Matter of fact, it was the first question I asked. What about the 13 weeks? What about the first trimester? He's like, that's not in there yet.
Okay.
So he's probably expecting, obviously, the bill's going to change because, it's like I said, the bill's introduced. It's the first start. And it is very rare that legislation that this consequential goes through without any amendments or without any changes whatsoever.
And already you're seeing a fairly enormous pushback. More than 200 independent businesses have signed a letter with the ACLU. In fact, their announcement was hosted in the lobby of our building here at Emmis headquarters. And Emmis was also a signatory on that letter appealing for legislators to maintain access to abortion. Do you think that, I mean, obviously you think that is going to move, especially since the tip from Rod Bray, it's not included yet. And tip in my hat here, I've given my opinion several times on this issue. I am quite comfortable with expanding access up to 15 to 20 weeks, consistent with most European limitations on abortion. And I think that those matters should be left between the mothers and their healthcare providers. That's my two cents on the issue. And these matters are going to be debated out in the General Assembly.
Yes. And what's interesting is lawmakers did some polling and sort of they didn't tell us exactly where their polling was on this issue per se, but we could tell that obviously life of the mother, rape and incest, most reasonable people can agree that if there's going to be an exemption of abortion, it should be those three common sense
exemptions.
Yeah, those three circumstances. Now, on the other hand, though, you've got the pro-life people upset. Right to Life said this doesn't go far enough. They wanted criminal penalties for doctors. You got the pro-choice people saying, hey, you're interfering with women's reproductive organs, which is why I said if the pro-life people and the pro-choice people are both mad at each other, then you're probably in the right place in that Venn diagram.
So how are Republicans going to thread the needle between those two disparate groups, especially because this legislation is not going to be the final iteration, and Republicans could effectively alienate a substantial portion of their base, but also could endanger their midterm prospects, depending on how this whole issue plays out. It's fascinating to me, and it comes at a very interesting time.
Well, I don't think it'll harm Indiana lawmakers, at least at the state house level, because the filing period's over, the ballot's going to be basically pretty much set. So I don't think they'll suffer too many consequences from that perspective. But you're right. It is going to be a contentious issue for the next 3 weeks and some change. And if I knew how this was going to turn out, we'd be having this conversation on my island that I just bought in the Bahamas because I just won the Powerball for $670 million.
Yeah. And I heard you talking about this on the air with Rob Kendall, and I appreciated you bringing up that Indiana is the only General Assembly or legislation in session or going to be in session on the 25th,
right,
which means that we are going to be the center of attention for national media. And this is not only a contentious issue for the state of Indiana, but this is going to be important for the entire nation. And it's being played out in the generals or in the legislatures right now. So Indiana could set the
and it's also taking place during Gen Con.
So Indiana could set the tone, tempo and pace for this discussion. We actually find ourselves at an interesting crossroads
again, because number one, the Greenwood Mall shooting got Indiana national attention.
Mm-hmm.
Todd Rokita and his idiotic comments got Indiana national attention. And now this. So it's like, can't we Indiana just be in the news for the Indy 500? Just for national attention? That's all I asked for.
And Gen Con flexed their muscles the last time there was some contentious legislation in the General Assembly with RFRA.
RFRA 2.0.
Yeah. And this has all of the potential to turn into that, especially without, I mean, the thing about the abortion debate is very frequently the sides that are most entrenched in the debate, they don't move. They don't move no matter how passionate the discussion becomes. This is very an emotionally invested topic, and that creates, it's the perfect
It's a perfect storm for
that's what I'm searching for.
Perfect storm for a very emotional issue. And what makes life even more interesting is come Monday, when the bill is introduced, there are going to be at least 3,000 people on the state house lawns on Capitol property protesting both pro-choice and pro-life. So, there we go.
And we hope that everything stays peaceful because, of course, and unfortunately, the 21st century, it seems like people don't have the ability to have a discussion without it becoming violent. They don't want to resolve arguments peaceably. Hopefully that won't be the case on the front lawn of the Indiana State House.
And it'll be interesting to see how people actually behave
right.
Because there are going to be protests all this weekend on Monument Circle. They've already started clearing, putting bags over the parking meters to ban parking off the circle because once again, it's going to be a big, giant protest for the next three. Actually, it's going to be a protest for the next 3 weeks and some change.
I was here during the 2020 riots doing my show Saturday night on The Circle when it hit, and I watched the rioters circle the building and smash windows and cause mayhem and destruction. I'd really like to not see a repeat of that. Do you think Indianapolis is burnt out?
I don't think it'll be that on The Circle. I just think it'll be people maybe kind of yelling and screaming, maybe voices elevated, you know, maybe a scuffle or two, but I don't see anybody, you know, doing property damage, because doing property damage doesn't win you any friends or influence people.
No. But at the same time, like we said, it's a perfect storm on a very emotional issue. And with the national media focusing its attention on Indiana, I just hope that tempers remain calm and reasonable heads prevail.
Well, I got to go get my mustache trimmed, my goatee trimmed, my hair colored, because I'm going to be on television when all this happens. So here we go again.
Your insights are invaluable, Abdul. Thanks for spending time with me on Saturday night on The Circle and shooting back some commentary about the abortion legislation about to hit the General Assembly on July 25th when the special session begins.
And no problem, my friend. Always glad to help.
You're listening to 93 WIBC. Stay tuned for more Saturday night on The Circle.
Listening to Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIPC.
Welcome back to this week's edition of Saturday Night on The Circle. We're going to return to a country in decay, left to crumble by dithering politicians disinterested in fixing the problems upon which they build the justification for their worthless re-election. Citizens are left to fend for themselves as government ceaselessly extorts an endless stream of tax revenue while leaving everything from infrastructure, borders, and the supply chain crisis left continually spiraling further beyond control. Finally, we'll conclude this dystopian comedic reflective with a cheerful video released by the New York City's Emergency Management Department warning you of what to do in a nuclear strike. Sure to put your mind at ease during times of stress and crisis. Hear it all on this week's edition of Hat Tricks with Hatcher.
It's time for another one of Hatcher's Hat Tricks.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle, where I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, and producer Carl is pushing those buttons and doing all the things to help the show run smoothly. We begin this week in Oakland, California, where self-described vigilantes are taking road repair into their own hands because, yes, although the government prohibitively confiscates tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue from the private citizenry, they cannot bring it to themselves to find the time to effectively fix the roads. Doesn't matter whether it's California, whether it's Indiana, whether it's New York, Massachusetts, everywhere, failure from the national to the local level, and it falls on the citizenry to be proactive and solve the problems government refuses to, this time stepping up and fixing potholes that the local government chooses to ignore.
We don't really know if it's legal. We don't have permits. We're out there in the middle of the night. Even though Oakland should be doing it themselves, they're not. So we're doing it. We are the pothole vigilantes. We're in our 20s, and we fill potholes in the dark of night. The streets of Oakland are crumbling away. There's a million potholes, so we don't plan where we're going to go because we're going to find a pothole no matter what. The cost to fill a pothole depends on how big it is, but the bag's around $20, and it takes 10 to 15 minutes to fix a problem. Oakland has a budget of $100 million and a three-year plan to fix the streets. If they gave us $1 million contract in 1 to 2 months, we'd fix all the problems. We stay anonymous because the problem is bigger than ourselves. This is not just about filling potholes. This is about fixing the community. The community has all been very supportive. Fix something when you see something broken. It's really that easy.
congratulations to these citizens for stepping up and taking ownership of and pride in their own community when the elected representatives choose not to. Now, that $1 million figure may be a little bit of an underbid because they were filling these potholes with loose pack asphalt. But that said, that's more loose pack asphalt than the city was choosing to invest in fixing the problem. No matter how temporary the solution may be, that is a step forward when compared to city services. So yes, I applaud the effort of these self-described vigilantes to take ownership of their community. Well done. It's not the first time that civilians in California have been forced to do so. Another local community, it wasn't Oakland. I forget the community, but they had been experiencing a rash of increases in pedestrian traffic collisions, and as a result, they decided to install some crosswalks at particular intersections, which had been brought to the attention of city representatives who dithered and dawdled and said that they would install them, but never did, and so it fell upon these civilians to put the crosswalks in, at which point the city unceremoniously removed them at the expense of taxpayers. They couldn't afford to install them in a timely manner, but they could afford to take them away, which is absolutely disgusting. To see the contempt that your elected representatives have for you at every level, again, local, national, it doesn't matter. And you can see this reflected in Alejandro Mayorkas outright denying the crisis on the border, which is besetting our national government right now. DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas insisting that it is, in fact, quite secure.
Is the border safe now? I was watching a news channel and they were talking about an invasion was happening and I got a little concerned.
Look, the border is secure. The border, we are working to make the border more secure. That has been a historic challenge.
At this point, we can say definitively that these blithe dismissals come at the cost of human lives, whether it's that the 10-year-old rape victim of an illegal immigrant who was forced to get an abortion here in Indiana and became the center of national attention beginning in the beginning of July, or whether it was the 50 bodies of illegal immigrants who had been smuggled across the border and left to die in the back of a trailer. These blithe dismissals come at the cost of human lives. And rather than addressing the issue, securing the border and helping protect the safety of those people, you know, the Biden administration sees fit to engage in this cartoonish, comical denial of reality, which is absolutely ridiculous. And instead of taking time to protect our borders, to solve the inflation crisis, to solve the supply chain crisis, or even begin addressing those issues, the Biden administration is largely concerned. It has concerned itself with making ideological pushes, including the mutilation of minors. This is Rachel Levine, Assistant Secretary for Health, saying that we need to empower these kids to undergo puberty blockers and surgery reassignment, effectively mutilating them before they've reached the age of adulthood.
So we really want to base our treatment and to affirm and to support and empower these youth, not to limit their participation in activities and sports, and even limit their ability to get gender affirmation treatment in their state.
So the Biden administration, instead of concerning itself with inflation, with borders, with supply chain, no, they're most concerned with making sure that your youngin can mutilate their genitalia before the age of adulthood, something which is not affirming or empowering, and more people are stepping up to reveal their paths from detransitioning and castigating the medical professionals who encourage them irresponsibly to go down that path. Some of these individuals having experienced severe bouts of depression, other mental health illnesses, thoughts of suicide, etc., and then being encouraged to seek a surgical solution for these problems, which in some cases has turned out to be temporary and met with regret by the recipient. So no, Dr. Rachel Levine, this is not helpful or helpful to the youth, and illustrative of the Biden administration's large contempt for the populace and its disinterest in solving serious problems. We continue to the problems that are facing, of course, Americans right now, most pertinent among them, including the inflation crisis. Shrinkflation coming to a shelf near you, according to a report from CBS. It is becoming more evident that your dollar goes it doesn't go as far as it used to at the grocery store, as containers are shrinking to account for the price increases.
The next time you're shopping, check closely. This Life cereal box recently got taller, but it lost 2.5 ounces. That's almost a bowl and a half of cereal. Experts call it shrinkflation.
Unfortunately, we're in the middle of a tidal wave of shrinkflation because of inflation.
Ed Dworsky founded ConsumerWorld.org, a consumer resource guide that investigates trends like shrinkflation.
It's a very sneaky way to pass on a price increase.
But he says companies are dealing with rising costs just like the rest of us.
They know consumers will notice a direct price increase, but they won't notice if the product gets a little bit smaller.
These Charmin toilet paper packages look the same, but Dworsky says the rolls recently got shorter by 30 sheets.
In 2008, ice cream came in half-gallon cartons. Then they went down to 56 ounces, and the current size is 48.
But ice cream maker Tillamook was very open about its decision, saying in order to be profitable, they decided on the option that would be least disruptive to their fans and keep the price the same.
They chose to cut the size by 14%. That means this carton used to have this much more ice cream.
Check out these bags of dog food.
The larger bag said you were getting 3 pounds free. The smaller bag says you're getting 4 pounds free for the same price. What gives?
There's no free lunch, even for your dog. It went from 50 pounds to 44. That's all you need to know. Forget about all the fanciful marketing language.
This is a serious problem. Your dollar is being stretched thinner than ever before, and the administration is at a loss of how to effectively address the crisis. Worse yet, they promise to contribute by continuing to print more dollars in an effort to stave off the crisis created by government intervention. And finally, in times of panic, crisis, and stress, the government is putting your mind at ease by releasing what to do in case of a nuclear attack. Lord knows what made the emergency response department or emergency management department over of in New York City to release this fine piece of media, but they did, and it sent alarm bells ringing to many citizens who thought that the risk of nuclear attack was minimal at best, but then they see this in their social media feeds.
So there's been a nuclear attack. Don't ask me how or why. Just know that the big one has hit, okay? So what do we do? There are three important steps that I want you to remember. Step one, get inside fast. You, your friends, your family, get inside. And no, staying in the car is not an option. You need to get into a building and move away from the windows.
Okay, so, I mean, they continue from here. The idea is that they're giving you information on how to protect yourself in case of a nuclear attack, but there's not been any indication that we're under any imminent threat of a nuclear attack, and releasing this video certainly didn't put the minds of the citizenry at ease. It's just curious to see that they've decided to release it now, but I guess forewarned is forearmed, as they say. You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle. Stay tuned for more content to come on the one, the only 93 WIBC.
I'm tickled pink that things are rosy and skies are blue once again.
This is Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
No more will I sigh or cry.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on The Circle. Hold on to your butts, ladies and gentlemen, because there are three major organizations promoting and managing the sport of Quidditch, which announced on Tuesday they're changing the name of the game to Quadball, partly to distance themselves from the Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. This is Saturday Night on The Circle. If you missed a moment of the program, catch the podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on The Circle. Fireside.fm. All right, so the International Quidditch Association, IQA, U.S. Quidditch, USQ, both governing bodies for the sport, joined Major League Quidditch, MLQ, a semi-professional league with 16 teams in the U.S. and Canada, announcing their official name change. Only one response is justified.
Ogre! 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 Ogre!
Where are they?
Ogre!
I think they're talking about us.
Ogre!
No way.
Ogre!
Nerds! Nerds! Nerds!
Come on, Lewis, let's go.
Nerds!
The QA, USQ, and MLQ made the decision rebranding themselves for two reasons. First and foremost, to distance themselves from the awful TERF, that's trans-exclusionary radical feminist, distancing themselves from TERF, J.K. Rowling, author of Harry Potter and progenitor of the sport which they play, that's irrelevant, but also a subsidiary reason because the trademark is a unique name and product of the film and media company Warner Brothers. They own the trademark for Quidditch, but not for quadball, so they would have proprietary ownership of the sport at that point, but it's all a little bit silly and as if we didn't need more reason to take these nerds less seriously. Also in the news this week, FedEx had to apologize on Twitter for losing a human corpse 3 years ago. In 2019, the partially decomposed body of Jeffrey Meriwether was found in Atlanta, Georgia. Medical examiner wanted to send his body for extra testing because he had been seen alive and well just a short time later, and yet his remains were discovered almost fully skeletonized. Instead of shipping them via the U.S. Post Service, which turns out is the only legal means you have to mail body parts, can't do it with anybody else besides the Post Service, but evidently this medical examiner didn't know that and elected to mail the skeletal remains to a lab in St. Louis for $32.61, which is pretty reasonable when you're mailing a human body. And FedEx lost the package. Nowhere to be seen. Somewhere in either their facilities or perhaps an erroneous delivery. They have lost the corpse, and of course, the family is enormously distraught, and I can't imagine what would happen. You know, this is a mystery unto itself, along with the enormous loss that the absence of their family's body member is inflicting on them. It's pretty awful, and just a strange story. But one wonders, of course, if somewhere out in the wide United States, if someone didn't receive that package by mistake, and maybe just, I don't know, kept it. Kind of a weird ornament, but you never know. This is Saturday Night on the Circle. More content to come. Stay tuned because in hour two, I'm inviting friend Terry Stacy onto the show. We're going to share our adventure antiquing in Zionsville with you and hopefully create afternoon outings for you to enjoy. Stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIPC.
Things are heating up at the White House as more criticism against Hunter Biden is being revealed. Ever more corruption coming into focus surrounding that family. Hunter Biden is now alleged to have met with his father at least 30 times in the White House or vice president's residence days after he returned home from overseas business jaunts between 2008 and 2016. You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, for hour two on this exciting program. Producer Carl, beep, 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 pushing those buttons and doing the things to make the show function. I hope you are excited and entertained as I am. And later in the show, I'm going to invite friend Terry Stacy onto the program, and we're going to share our excursion in Zionsville earlier this week and hopefully share the opportunity for you to have a day trip of your own. all that up this hour. But first, again, we're beginning with Hunter Biden accused of meeting with his father more than 30 times after his business trips between 2008 and 2016, raising questions about whether he was relaying messages to his father on behalf of these foreign dignitaries and business partners, casting doubts on the president's repeated claim that he had no role in his son's overseas business dealings or knowledge thereof. Meetings were found in a review of personal calendar on Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop. And if journalists at the Washington Post are to be believed is true, Hunter Biden himself was a prolific self-documentarian. There's more, several years worth of content on this laptop to examine, investigate, and release. And it is now being death by a thousand cups, a slow drip campaign of releases, damaging the credibility of the administration with each new revelation. House GOP Conference Chair Elise Stefanik has promised to subpoena Hunter Biden should Republicans win back control of Congress in 2022, and said that it's more evidence of corruption in the Biden family, telling the Post, hardly a day goes by without another revelation about how intimately involved Joe Biden was with his son Hunter Biden's corrupt foreign business dealings. The fact that Joe was in meetings with senior foreign leaders on behalf of Hunter and his business associate while vice president further proves that Joe has been lying to the American people, and goes to show that Trump's accusations of corruption in the Biden family weren't as far-fetched as some media figures would have liked you to believe. In fact, there is now substantial evidence of corruption, especially surrounding Hunter Biden, who on many occasions has been the beneficiary of the prominence granted by his family's name and access to the upper echelon of American government. Disgusting by any evaluation. Another thing to pay attention to this week, of course, is the House, which passed the Respect for Marriage Act, which would protect marriage equality, repealing the Defense of Marriage Act, providing federal protections for same-sex and interracial couples. This could be very important because, of course, Justice Clarence Thomas tipped the hat that possibly the Obergefell ruling could be overturned in the Supreme Court, and so this would preemptively protect the right for same-sex couples to get married. Bill passing 267 to 157. 47 Republicans joined every Democrat voting in favor of the bill, and other Republicans, of course, voting against it, saying that the protections were unnecessary. I think that is a tenuous suggestion at best, considering the foreshadowing offered by Justice Clarence Thomas there. Democrats mounted the legislative response this week in response to the concurring opinion by the justice, suggesting that Supreme Court decisions involving access to contraception and same-sex marriages should be reconsidered, holding votes on defense of marriage as well as access to contraception this week. While the Supreme Court struck down sections of the DOMA in U.S. versus Obergefell v. Hodges, the law still remains on the books. Republican Susan Collins of Maine is a backer of the marriage equality measure, and GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said she would like to see contraception and same-sex marriage rights protected under federal law. Republicans, too, have indicated they'll support the measure. Other Republicans indicated they'll support the measure since its passage by the House. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio also co-sponsoring the Senate's version of the measure, his office said. And Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina said they probably will vote to enshrine the right to same-sex marriage into federal law. These issues are important to discuss, especially since some of these matters are being reconsidered by the Supreme Court. It is not at all far-fetched to suggest that it may be necessary to enshrine these rights as a matter of codification rather than relying on judicial intervention to protect them. And ultimately, that may be the better path. In either event, I think the bill certainly has some merits. Finally, something I wanted to discuss, Robb Elementary School shooter, the mother lashed out at grieving relatives of parents of children who were killed in the massacre, telling them that they had no right to judge her son. This was an exchange that was caught by Telemundo cameras who were following the family after a school event for the parents of children who were murdered, and they caught this exchange on camera.
You have no right to judge my son. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. No. May God
forgive you.
So this was after residents met in the small town dealing with a meeting after the enormous tragedy, and it led to that conflict. Gartha's grandmother, Dana Mendoza, insists that the mother shares responsibility for the mass shooting, saying that she's not innocent. She raised him like that. She knew how he was. She knew he had guns. She's not innocent. So, I mean, if your grandmother is going to say that about the mother, it calls into question of course, the environment that child was raised in, and we can't imagine it was terribly helpful considering how he lashed out in a violent way, resulting in the mass fatality of children at the school. You're listening to 93 WIBC. A lot more to cover on the program. Coming up next, solar power is failing critically in England as temperatures become too hot for the energy producers to function. And we'll tell you more about that coming up next. So stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
Things that bother you never bother me. I feel happy and fine. Ha-ha! Living in the sunlight, loving in the moonlight, having a wonderful time.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Well, looks like solar power is not the salvation green energy proponents promise it to be. And in fact, this story is part of the prime reason I continue to push for the expansion of nuclear energy production in America. If the frogs can figure it out in France with more than 70% of power being generated from nuclear sources, I think the Yanks in America can get that handled as well. You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle, 93 WIBC. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, producer Carl on the board, pushing those buttons and doing the things to make the show function. We begin in England, where it looks like solar panels aren't going to be saving the planet anytime soon. Some of them aren't even able to work efficiently when the sun is too hot. Reports indicate record heat waves tormenting the United Kingdom have effectively rendered some of the panels there useless. According to the Telegraph of London reporting on Tuesday, temperatures of over 104 degrees for the first time ever in Britain negatively impacted local solar panels' ability to store energy. As temperatures rise above 77 degrees, solar panels become 0.35 percentage points less efficient with each increasing degree. Now, it should be noted, the past few weeks have been far from a failure on the solar energy front, but their output is limited. According to Fortune, Germany hit record levels of solar energy output over the weekend, although that comes with a caveat, because if temperatures remain elevated for long, that output will certainly regress and calls into question forecasts offered by climate change activists who say that as we are going to continually warm, which means their energy alternatives will be progressively less effective and dig us further and further into a hole, which is not good. Also, some of the alternatives being proposed, like electric cars, have come under scrutiny, as in some cases, the cost of replacing the battery can be more than the vehicle itself. So on the one hand, you have solar green energy production services not functioning up to peak capacity and in fact dwindling their performance as temperatures rise, meaning that they will be less capable of powering these electric vehicles, which themselves are more pricey to repair and maintain. This coming true for a family in St. Petersburg, Florida, where a 17-year-old was excited to get her first car, an $11,000 used electric vehicle, a Ford Focus Electric 2014 model with only 60,000 miles, which means that in 5 years, average service time, these vehicles need a full battery replacement costing in excess of $14,000, $3,000 more than the vehicle itself cost used at an initial purchase. And that didn't even include the cost of labor and installation. So this is enormously financially prohibitive. And not at all effective if you plan on doing very much driving, because the average mileage, I think, is about 10 to 12,000 miles per year. So again, if this is a 60,000 mile vehicle that already needed the battery replaced, that means you are getting an incredibly short lifespan and having to replace potentially the full vehicle every 5 years. most Americans can't afford to do that. And certainly conventionally powered vehicles have much more longevity, it seems. And we have yet to also observe the impact on the environment that's caused from the battery storage and disposal as we continue to pop these things out. So yeah, there are lots of lingering questions. And the salvation, as described by climate change activists, is not as true as they would like to advertise. Finally, I want to talk about farmers in Netherlands. This is important because the Netherlands punches well above their weight in agricultural output, but radical green initiatives could all but wipe out the country's thriving agricultural sector, which would put thousands of farmers out of business. And the farmers are fighting back. They're in an uproar of the government's environmental plans, and many face what they say is an impossible or ultimatum: sort out nitrogen pollution or sell off the farms. One of the farmers, Ad Baltus, a 52-year-old in Alkmaar in North Holland, says, "I think there's an agenda to make Holland a different country, and the farmers are standing in the way. They want to change the whole landscape. More nature, more solar panel fields that will become less effective as temperatures rise, and the need for they need grounds for houses, industry, and space, and that is currently being taken up by farmers that they're wishing to edge out." The Netherlands actually producing a comparably agricultural output to the Ukraine or the United States, which is enormously impressive considering their size. And this threatens the stability of the international food market, which, again, it seems like these climate change activists are largely unconcerned with the impacts that their short-sighted regulations impose. After years of pressure, The Hague unveiled radical proposals that they hope will deal with the nitrogen problem for good. Compelled by the EU and national court rulings to tighten their measures, Dutch government now planning to have nitrogen emissions overall by 2030. The agricultural sector must reduce nitrogen pollution by up to 70%. And farms in the EU-designated Natura 2000 habitat protected zones face the toughest restrictions, which would put many of them out of business or shut them down altogether. The Hague earmarked $25 billion euros to fund nitrogen-cutting technologies or buy out certain farms. But again, that's not a solution because it also ultimately does not replace food production services. And there is no replacement for farmers. They, of course, feed the world, and these short-sighted regulations are going to endanger the food supply at a time when we're already facing supply chain crises. Absolutely ridiculous. But the short-sightedness is certainly born of agenda-driven rhetoric. You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle. More content to come. I had an exciting adventure with the Terry Stacey of The First Day Show, heard every Sunday from 9 to noon here on 93 WIBC. We went out to Zionsville and had an exciting excursion at a local restaurant and antique store. I hope you'll stay tuned for that adventure coming up next on 93 WIBC.
I love those dear hearts and gentle people.
This is Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
Because those dear.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of Saturday Night on The Circle with me, your happy host, Ethan Hatcher. It's my pleasure and privilege to return to these 93 WIBC airwaves once again. And if you were tuning into my show a few weeks ago, you may recall me teasing a future adventure excursion between Terry Stacey and myself. Well, finally, after much ado, we had the opportunity to venture forth and had an excellent time. I hope you enjoy our outing. The idea is for Terry and I to find local area small business antique stores and pair them with area restaurants and create afternoon excursions that you can share in. So we have an adventure and then you can go have an adventure, pick up some treasures, have some good eats, have an excellent time, make some new friends, and get to see and enjoy this wonderful state that we live in. So without much ado, we began our adventure in Zionsville, Indiana at Brown's Antique Store on 5th, and boy, it was really special. Here's our conversation with owner David Brown.
Terry Stacey along with Ethan Hatcher, and we are at a place that is like I'm in a whole new world in Zionsville. Ethan, you brought me here. Where are we?
We're on Browns on 5th in Zionsville, and the place is like a time warp. It's a family-owned antique store that is absolutely gorgeous, a little multi-unit property, and we're talking with the owner who's giving us a little bit of history on where it comes from and just a little bit about the family business.
Yeah, this is Mr. Brown. How are you, sir? Thank you so much for talking to us today. Tell me about the history of this property.
Well, first of all, I'm David Brown. I grew up on this property. My parents moved on to this property in 1940 as newlyweds, started their little antique shop 5 years later in a little building they built, and the rest is history. They were within 4 or 5 years, they were making enough money. My dad quit his job at Allison's and mom and dad did this for the rest of their lives, and they didn't retire. They died right here on the property at 92 and 88, and they were still working this business at that point. And I joined them after high school and thought I would do it for a couple years till I found out what I really wanted to do with my life, and 50 years later, here I'm still here.
How many, tell everybody about how many buildings are on this property.
Well, we actually have 3 full buildings full of antiques and vintage merchandise, a lot of mid-century, and just cool stuff. And one thing that we do have here, besides antiques and vintage merchandise, is we have Indiana's largest selection of new replacement lampshades as well. That's gotten to be a niche of our business over the last 30 or 40 years. And in one of our buildings, we actually have the largest selection of replacement lampshades for all kinds of lamps you'll find anywhere in central Indiana.
You've been in business since the 1950s, so that's...
1945.
Okay, so how has antiquing changed over the years? Because like the interest has changed, people's what they're looking for has changed.
Well, we've seen a big change. My father and mother said that when they first started the business, people weren't really into antiques in the 40s and 50s. They were starting to want all the modern stuff following the big war, and so antiques weren't really popular, and then they got really popular in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, especially country items were really big in the last part of the 20th century, so to speak. Now it's completely changed, and country and early American items aren't as desirable to most people unless you're an avid collector. Now young people and most people that are buying want more mid-century, basically things from the 1930s through the 60s is really the most popular era of antiques or vintage merchandise now.
Stuff so their parents remember. Stuff their parents remember.
Exactly.
You know?
Vinyl records.
Yeah.
Old books.
Yeah.
Et cetera.
Yeah. But when we talk about old, you know, when is something considered vintage or when does something become an antique? How old does it have to be? Well, because I want to tell you that I got socked in the gut the other day when somebody said something from 1980 was cool. And I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. I was in high school in 1980. Is that really old now? Yeah. Well, okay, stop laughing, Ethan, because it's going to hit you too at some point.
Well, the term antique and vintage is extremely misunderstood and misused by everybody. It used to be, when I first came into the business, things basically had to be 100 years old to be considered an antique. That has really gone by the wayside anymore. I personally think anything from about 1930 or 40 is antique, yeah. But and vintage would be more in from the 30s to the 60s. I'm still not carrying a lot of 70s things yet, but like I say, those terms are used very loosely anymore. When the young people say something's old, they do think almost the 90s or 80s or 70s.
It kicks you right in the gut, Ethan.
Now, one of the coolest things that I thought was on this property is your 19th century museum, and that's your little personal collection of stuff in this little outbuilding over here. Can you tell us about that and maybe show us some of your favorite items?
Certainly. One of the old buildings that came on this property was a little backyard tool shed that was probably from the late 1800s, and my dad like to preserve things and keep things for his own personal collection. So he turned that into a little 19th century museum, especially specializing in things from the early 1800s up till maybe the Civil War era. So we'll go take a look at that here in a minute. And I'd love to show it to you because I don't get a lot of people that really see and appreciate that sort of thing as much as they like to. So I like to turn them on to a different era.
You know, what do you love to collect yourself?
Right now, I'm got to the age I'm not buying and collecting as much as I used to earlier. I used to be really into, and I still have a huge political collection.
Oh, I love that.
And I still do have that. I like early sports stuff as well. And of course, I love early American furniture, that, which I just said is not as popular as it used to be. But my wife and I, our house is absolutely full of pine and cherry furniture from the mid to early 1800s.
Oh, wow. When you describe what you have here, what do you tell people? If somebody's looking for something, what do you tell them you carry here?
Well, first of all, when I talk to people about this place, I like to make sure that they understand what a beautiful setting it is.
Yeah.
And my dad and mom loved England. They traveled to England probably 20 times. They probably went there their last time when they were 90 years old and they were still traveling abroad.
Oh, wow.
But every year my dad would come back and have ideas on how to make this more like an English country garden. And that's what we've continued to do. So when people come here, that's basically what they're going to see. They're going to see three little charming buildings nestled on an English garden setting. And it's kind of like a little bit of paradise when you walk in here, especially on a hot 90-degree summer day. One thing about it, there's not many, and I say it proudly, little mom-and-pop stores left, whether it's antique shops or other in our society anymore. And I'm proud that we have one that's survived 77 years. And still, I get people from all over the United States coming in every day that their jaw drops, and I'm proud to be a part of that.
I love it. We're going to go in and take a look at this 19th century museum.
Okay, so we got to leave it there for a short break, but I hope you'll stay tuned because in the next segment, we're going to continue our discussion with owner David Brown of Brown's on 5th in Zionsville. And boy, it was an amazing excursion. I hope you're enjoying it so far. Coming up in the next segment, he's going to give us a tour of the outbuilding on his property, which functions as a 19th century museum that was stuffed with some really special treasures. I've got some of it posted on social media so you can see and experience it for yourself, but also make sure you visit because this place is worth the trip. We're also going to tie in the area restaurant Friendly's Tavern in the next segment and give you a review of some of the items we got to sample and enjoy for ourselves. You don't want to miss out. They did a fantastic job. Stay tuned for all that coming up next on Saturday Night on the Circle. Catch my podcast at saturdaynightonthecircle.fireside.fm and stay tuned to 93 WIBC.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on the Circle. I'm your humble host, Ethan Hatcher, producer Carl, beep, 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 pushing those buttons and doing the things necessary to make the show function. Appreciate your hard work as usual, Carl, and we're coasting things to a close here on a busy Saturday evening. I hope you've enjoyed the show so far. If you missed a moment, catch my podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on the Circle.fireside.fm. We've been having a conversation with a small business owner, David Brown of Brown's on 5th in Zionsville. Terry Stacy and I, part of an adventure series that we're hoping to launch and share with you, in which we go to area antique stores and pair them with restaurants so that way you can have afternoon excursions around the Hoosier heartland and experience the best that this beautiful state has to offer. So we began our excursion, our adventures in Zionsville at Brown's on 5th, and owner David Brown was sharing an outbuilding on his property, which is been converted into a 19th century museum stuffed with treasure. Absolutely incredible. And here's where we resume our conversation.
All right. So we're standing here in this little 19th century museum on Browns on Fifth in Zionsville, and we're talking to the owner, David Brown. And just tell us a little bit about the history of this building. You said it was an original building to the property, an outbuilding, and then you have filled it with 19th century furniture, early 19th century stuff in the 1800s, all the way up to the Civil War. So tell us more about the items and some of your favorites in the collection.
Well, we specialize really in our room here in Lincoln memorabilia. Our family has always loved what he did for this country, and being from the Midwest, so we have quite a nice display of Lincoln memorabilia, a lot of pictures, and everything's authentic. I even have a Lincoln button, original Lincoln button from 1860, a political campaign button.
Oh,
here.
Wow. Those can't be incredibly common.
Well, I don't think they probably are. Probably most people don't even notice it, but I got one with from 1860, but we got a lot of original artwork, prints, etc., from the early to mid 1800s as well. We have an old Zionsville newspaper here from about 1876, which is pretty unique given the history of Zionsville. And we carry, we have a lot of really neat things. We have a Revolutionary War uniform here that actually dates from the centennial in 1876, but it's an exact replica of the Revolutionary War. Got an old shoebox up here that is from my great-grandfather. He had a business on West Washington Street back in mid to late 1800s. They're just a lot of cool stuff here that I just don't want to part with. And
oh, no, absolutely not. This is a building that is full of treasures, and I like when you step in. It has that rich, that smell of history, you know. I love the smell of the old antiques and the stuff in here. It really is a beautiful slice of Americana that you've carved for yourself. And it's really cool that you share it with people, because some collectors, they hide it away, they keep it in their house, and only maybe friends or family ever get to see it. But the fact that you are willing to let people walk in among this, I think, is very generous.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody that comes to Brown's Antiques any day of the week, you're welcome to come in and peruse this as well.
There are so many things in here that stuff just pops out. You have to go around it several times inside this room, this cozy room, to see everything, because there's so many really cool items. What do you think you have? Because obviously you've bought and sold. Oh, there's liquor. Wait a minute. What's that? The liquor bottle. What is that from?
This is actually a furniture polish, probably from the 1920s or 30s. Can you believe
that? Wow. See? Furniture polish in what looks like a whiskey bottle.
Yeah, it does.
With a cork.
I know it.
And
I've never seen one like it until I saw this, and I thought, I got to keep that.
Never seen that before. And any antique dealer, never seen that. So, see, I'm sorry. I just get stuff is just jumping out at me.
Building, right. You'd have to come back for multiple trips to appreciate all the items, which is what I think is really cool.
Yeah, me too. All of the things that the political buttons. I have tens and tens of old political buttons, and
if you were starting
love
housekeeping
them.
In 1820, pretty much everything you put and needed to start a living in a log cabin out in the wilderness is right here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
So this is like a survivalist dream.
I mean, just the structure itself is pretty phenomenal. You've done a great job preserving it. And I love that part of it, that we're in an actual antique. Uh-huh. We're inside of an antique. It's just phenomenal. The tools and the wooden shoes.
The wooden shoes might not be completely appropriate for this room, but those are from the 1800s.
That's all I care about is 1800s. I like them,
They're probably from Holland.
Thank you for sharing this with us.
Happy to.
So after Ethan stopped the tape and we'd seen all that we needed to see, we were starving.
It's time to eat.
it was time to eat, and we did, and Ethan says, let's go to...
We're going to go to the Friendly Tavern, because part of these adventures is about eating local and finding those little niche establishments that, you know, don't get publicized, and sharing those and hopefully finding some good eats, which, Terry, I believe we did.
Loved it. Oh, I loved the service. I loved, I mean, they were friendly. Everybody treated us great. The servers, the gentleman that maybe even owns the place.
Yeah.
Stopped by and made sure we were comfortable and we had everything we wanted. We took lots of pictures, you guys, so you can find them both on Ethan's social media and also on my social media. The food was outstanding, and probably a lot of you know this about Friendly's, that it was just good, known for their tenderloin. So Ethan got a tenderloin.
Their tenderloin, I gotta say, was probably in the top 10. I'd have to do a closer evaluation, but for people who enjoy a good tenderloin and were bemoaning the loss of Edwards Drive-In over on the south side.
Yes?
Oh, it was heartbreaking. This isn't quite a replacement, but man, they do a good job. What it reminded me of, oh man, another tenderloin place that we lost, Bearcat Alley Grill over in the Stutz building.
So good.
Definitely on par with that. Oh man, it was
just
tasty.
Good. White meat tenderloin. I mean,
and I got the fries instead of the chips, and I think that was worth the extra $1.25.
But you know what? We also ordered hors d'oeuvres.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I had a taco salad, and it was a fine, good taco salad. I just was craving a taco salad. Wish I'd have gotten a burger, because I know they're also known for their good burgers. But we got hors d'oeuvres, and I got a spinach and asparagus. I don't remember. It was a spinach dip of some sort that was just good, and I loved it. But Ethan
got...
Was
it a spinach artichoke dip?
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Spinach artichoke. I almost said asparagus, which is weird. It was good.
An asparagus dip, Terry.
Very good. But Ethan got wings. Oh.
I think that was the winner of the hors d'oeuvres.
The winner.
Yeah, the honey.
So good.
The barbecue apple smoked chicken wings were absolutely fantastic. It's been a while since I've gotten some good wings, and they definitely blow B-dubs out of the water.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're looking for local wings, Friendly's Tavern, yeah, definitely near the top.
Absolutely.
On par with Ale Emporium, if you like local wings and know them.
Just crispy and well done and just so good. The great sauce.
Not burnt, not dry, perfect. Moist, perfectly cooked, well portioned. Yeah, well priced too for the portion. You get a big old heaping plate of wings for less than $20. I was satisfied,
really
took
good.
Some home, and I plan to have some for dinner later this evening.
So good. And again, if that appetizer alone would have fed us for the rest of the day. It's a shareable appetizer.
Oh, for sure.
So good. Reasonably priced for the fantastic service.
And the
good
aromas
people.
Are so inviting. When we were on our way inside from the parking lot, you could smell the cooked smoking meats wafting across through the atmosphere. It was perfect.
We
the ambiance. Yeah, no, the ambiance was good. It was very clean. The service was spectacular. They always made sure to top off our drinks. They made sure that we had everything we need, the napkins, the silverware, etc. They boxed up our stuff for us. They put it in a little bag. It was great. I'd definitely come back to Friendly Tavern, living up to the name in Zionsville.
Yeah, me too. And I know a lot of you have talked about it before, but that was our first time, and I will go back again. That will be on, that is really, right now, is sitting at like my top 5 list of good restaurants to eat, especially because of those wings, and the tenderloin was just beautiful. So that's what we're doing right now. If you all have any suggestions on where we might go next, again, we love going to antique stores. Ethan loves vinyl. He loves all kinds of antiques, but I just like everything. So good ideas where you are. If you are one of those that has a little antique shop, mom and pop is what we love. Also a good place to eat, mom and pop. Next time we may venture into Pendleton. We're kind of doing some research right now. We appreciate the suggestions, but we'll keep at this. And we're having fun.
Yeah. Adventures with Terry and Ethan. I'm still workshopping the name. Antiquing Afternoons with Ethan and Terry. Something like
maybe
that.
Maybe something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something good. Anyway, Ethan, thanks for inviting me to be a part of this. And we'll be out again soon.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to more adventures in the near future. And thanks for joining us on our adventure in Zionsville, dear listener. I hope you were thoroughly entertained by our excursion, but don't just listen to Terry as Stacy and I have fun on these adventures. Use the opportunity yourself to plan a day trip and show your support for these small businesses. Businesses like the Friendly Tavern and Brown's on Fifth in Zionsville need your support in a struggling economy, and these small businesses are unique in how they capture the beauty and the best that small town America has to offer. This is your chance to experience the beauty of the heartland. Get out and travel. We've been cooped up entirely too long, suffering through a pandemic when we were locked down and shuttered away from our friends and family. Well, now it's time to get out, break out, have fun. Even with the high gas prices, it's worth it to suffer. Even just to enjoy an afternoon. I hope you've been entertained by this week's edition of Saturday Night on the Circle. I leave you with my parting words of wisdom. As always, wherever you are, whoever you're with, whatever you're doing, remember that life is a state of mind. See you next week.